Equal access to justice is a core American value. In each episode of Talk Justice, an LSC podcast, we'll explore ways to expand access to justice and illustrate why it is important to the legal community, business, government, and the general public. Talk Justice is sponsored by the Leaders Council of the Legal Services Corporation.
Hello, I'm Ron Flagg, president of LSC, here to introduce today's episode. Earlier this month, LSC held our 50th anniversary celebration in Washington, D.C., where we brought together the executive directors and board chairs of the 130 legal aid providers that LSC funds for a series of events, some educational, others inspiring or entertaining. The segment that we're about to share with you, I think, is all three. In this conversation, John Grisham, the best-selling author, lawyer, and advocate for access to justice, is brilliantly interviewed by LSC board member Robert Gray, the president of the Leadership Council on Legal Diversity. LSC is honored to have John Grisham on our Leaders Council, and we hope that you enjoy learning more about his life, law career, philanthropic philosophies, and his sense of humor on this episode of Talk Justice. I'll pass it off now to Robert Gray to properly introduce our guest.
My name is Robert Gray, and I serve on the board of the Legal Services Corporation. Those who tell the story write the history. We are fortunate to have a very able storyteller with us today. But it didn't start there. Each time we meet, it's an oral history of who we are, recorded for those who will come after us, so that they will continue to carry the baton that has been passed to them to keep America safe, to keep America democratic, and to keep America fair. For all of its citizens, for all of its people, both nationally and internationally. The story that Doug Eakley and Secretary Clinton told yesterday was important to hear again. This morning I met with Bucky Askew and a couple of other colleagues. Bucky, thank you for reminding me of our history. When I first joined the ABA, I met a guy named Tom Smagle, the longest serving member of the LSC board in its history. Tom, thank you for sharing that history. Let's get after it. I want you to join me in welcoming a lawyer, an author, and a philanthropist, John Grisham. John and I are going to have a conversation with you, for you, through you, and hopefully we will record more of our history. John, would you join me on stage? There's a place in America called Jonesboro, Arkansas. Young man born there, whole future ahead of him, made some choices in life. And one of those choices was to be part of the solution for how we maintain a standard of excellence, a standard of justice, and a standard for human behavior. How old were you, 7 years old when you concluded? Oh, I'm sorry. I'm going to have a conversation with John, and we've decided that
it is best to be somewhat spontaneous. I said, well, you know, we've got a script here. He said, I read the script. Let's have a conversation. Give me a little bit of Jonesboro, Arkansas family then and family now.
Sure. My father was a sharecropper, cotton farmer, in actually Black Oak, Arkansas, but the nearest hospital was Jonesboro, and so we were all born there. Those were pretty rough days. I do recall picking cotton and chopping cotton, and those are not fond memories. By the time I was seven, my father had lost everything, and his land was not that productive. And we left the farm actually in the middle of the night to avoid, I think, debt collectors. And we took off. And my dad got a job as a bulldozer operator with a construction company. And they moved us around all over the Mid-South for several years, mainly in Mississippi. And then when I was 12 or 13, we settled very near Memphis. All the towns were around Memphis. And that's why Memphis has always been kind of the home area. By the time I was 15, though, things had improved dramatically. My father worked a double shift and was very frugal. My mom worked, and you know, we were living in the suburbs, and life picked up. We had better schools, but leaving the farm was one of the most important moments in my life, because I didn't realize it. But my cousins did not leave the farm, and they should have. It's not a good way to live. But we had better schools, better opportunity. My parents dreamed of all of us going to college. I had five kids. And so I was able to go to college. My parents couldn't go. And at some point, about halfway through college, after 2 years of having a whole lot of fun, I realized that my grades were not too impressive, and I couldn't party for the rest of my life. And we were a very strict Southern Baptist home where everything was illegal. I mean, you can't do anything. So we couldn't wait to get away from home and have some fun out in the world. And so I had a lot of fun my first 2 years. And I was inspired to go to law school. And the reason for that was you know, with my background, I wanted to do something, if I could, to maybe give me a chance to make a little money, you know, for the first time, or get a more prestigious position or whatever. So I went to law school and finished at Ole Miss, and went back to my hometown outside of Memphis, and hung out my shingle and declared my own law firm. I couldn't get a job, and well, there weren't any really real jobs in the county. I don't want to go anywhere else, and so I hung out my shingle and just said, "Hey, I'm ready to start suing people." And I was a new gunslinger in town with no ammunition. I was just, I'm ready. I'm ready to go. And one of my first clients had a profound impact on me as a lawyer, as a person, as a human being. And they were very low-income people who found their way to my office.
You know, it is about the choices we make and the circumstances that sort of presented to us that inform our vision of where we're going to go in life. So, and this is a very interesting story, but that client provided you with an opportunity to become a leader in the community.
Yeah, they were, they lived in a trailer park. They were about to be evicted from the trailer, and they had just got the piece of paper to be in court tomorrow. And there was a, we had legal aid back then, but the nearest office was an hour and a half away. And what the older lawyers would do in the town would send all of the bad clients to the new guys in town. And so these people found their way to my office. I was the rookie. And they were husband and wife, small kid, and they were really in despair. But they were working poor, and they were about to be evicted. And they lived in a trailer park that we all knew about the trailer park. It was not a nice place, but it's probably about 10 miles away in our county. And the only place they could live. The rent was exorbitant. And I took landlord-tenant law in law school, learned nothing. And then, so I reviewed their case, and I said, why don't y'all go next door? But I figured the guy next door sent them over to me. And I realized, well, this is one of my first week or so in the law office, the law business. I just couldn't say no to people who needed help. I could not say no. I could not tell these people, look, you can't afford to pay me a dime. I can't take your case. Because where would they go? There was no other place for them to go. And so I took their case. And by the time we got to court the next morning, they had some neighbors with them who were also being evicted. I picked up four more clients. We walked into court, and I wasn't sure what to do, but the judge was a good person. I knew him pretty well. The landlord was there, and he was not a good person. He was famous, infamous. And when I walked up to the bench, they call the case, I walked up with my clients, the first two clients, first couple. And when they realized that these poor people had a lawyer, everything changed. Everything changed. You've seen it happen. You live it, okay? Low-income people get run over all the time unless they show up with a lawyer. And I realized the power of a law degree, the power of a law license at that moment. And the judge said, Mr. Grisham, you represent these people? And I said, yes, sir. On what basis? I wasn't sure what he's talking about. So I just said, judge is pro bono. And the client whispered to me, said, what's pro bono? What's pro bono? And I said, well, I think it means that you don't have to pay and I don't get paid. And he liked that. It was okay with him. Yeah. It's a good deal. And so we roughed up the landlord pretty good. I stayed up half the night reading the landlord, the code sections, and there were a lot of errors, a lot of code sections. He had cut corners, and so I had these four or five clients who were all being evicted. We got all the cases kicked out, and I had had time that morning to prepare a three-page lawsuit suing the landlord for this and that and the violations, and also just for fun, a bunch of punitive damages, which scared the shit out of the guy, okay? Suddenly he was sued for $100,000. And we walked out, and I basically at that point owned the trailer park. They were all mine.
You also got a nickname.
Yeah, they couldn't grasp the pro bono concept, and so they started calling me Lawyer Bono. Lawyer, here comes Lawyer Bono.
Which provided you with a pipeline of clients.
Oh, I had more clients than I could deal with. I had one secretary I could barely pay. We had to hire another one just to keep up with the people. There were about 100 families in the trailer park, and suddenly they all had problems, and they were the legitimate problems. And I tried my best to help them, and there were some criminal charges, as you might guess, and it was really, I mean, I was going to lose some serious money with these people, and I was trying to make a living. And then a few months later, I guess about a year later, a family was from the trailer park. My people was involved in a terrible car wreck involving an 18-wheeler that was heavily insured and a driver who was drinking. And so my ship came home real soon. We got a nice settlement, and suddenly I could breathe.
Practicing law, as my mentor told me, is a full contact sport. And you're either on the field trying to score and win, or you're a spectator. He looked at me, he said, Bobby, which one are you? You were on the field, you were trying to score and win, you were practicing law.
Yeah, at the same time, to generate fees, I was taking all the court-appointed criminal cases I could possibly handle. There were a lot of them. Again, it was a tradition in the county that the older lawyers had taken those cases. There was no public defender service, so the pro bono, the indigent cases were passed out piecemeal by the judges to really whoever wanted them. So I raised my hand and took a lot of criminal cases, and I had two murder trials, not capital, but murder trials. My first year out of law school, I tried by myself to jury verdict and got not guilty verdicts. And I really enjoyed, I had this dream of being a big time plaintiff's lawyer. I wanted the courtroom stuff, I wanted the experience. I really wanted to help people who were getting, I sued insurance companies. My clients were the working poor on this side of the street. Across the street were the insurance companies and the banks, the employers and the government, whatever, you know, the people with money. And I really got into the trial lawyer syndrome of taking the little guy to court and defeating Goliath. I had no idea that was gonna spill over into my fiction, because back then I wasn't thinking about fiction. I didn't dream of being a writer. It's not something I studied. It happened later in life. I was, you know, 30 years old in a courtroom, my courtroom, DeSoto County Courthouse in Hernando, Mississippi. And I saw a trial, I saw something that was extremely dramatic, and it inspired me to try to write that story. And if I hadn't been there that day and seen that and become obsessed with this idea that became A Time to Kill, I would have never written it.
So here is the beginning of he who tells the story writes the history. And you started with A Time to Kill. How did that go over?
It was a total flop. The book, I was lucky enough to get the book published. It was exciting to get a phone call from an agent in New York. That was the first magical phone call. And the guy called and said, I want to represent you. And I thought, this is great. I can't believe it. A year later, he called and said, I found a publisher. I've sold the book. And I said, who's the publisher? I'd never heard of the publisher. It was an unknown small press in New York. And but it didn't matter. I had a contract. $15,000 advance for A Time to Kill, which I thought was pretty good money in 1987, 88. And I'd been writing every day for 3 years to write A Time to Kill. And so when that was over, I told my wife, who is my first reader and my, you know, best friend, and she's an English major, and so she's a pretty tough critic. I said, I'm going to write one more book after A Time to Kill, and if the second book flops, you can forget this little career. I'll just keep suing people, or maybe become a judge, or go back to my trial lawyer, something. And so I wrote, in 2 years, I wrote the second book, which was called The Firm. And when The Firm came out in March of 91, it was an immediate bestseller, and my whole life was changing rapidly. Once I got the dream, about halfway through my 10-year legal career, which is not much time, I got the dream of writing full-time. No pressure, no clients, no trials, no judges, just sitting back somewhere and writing full-time. I couldn't imagine that dream, but it was so wonderful to think about, and suddenly there it was. And I got up from my office and I walked out the door. I didn't turn off the lights. I slammed the door and I said, I'm no longer a lawyer. I'm gonna write full-time.
It turned out pretty good. You have sold over 300 million copies of your stories. You are translated in over 47 countries. You have 10 consecutive bestsellers. I'm sorry, 37 consecutive bestsellers in 10 movies.
I'm going to correct you in just a moment. Actually, it's closer to 400 million, but who's counting, right? I see those numbers. I know how many languages there are, because we sell the foreign rights language by language, so I keep up with those. But somebody at AA sits around, and about every 5 years, they'll raise the number. It was 250, 300, 350. There's no way in the world they know. No one keeps up with how many books I sell in South Korea or, you know, Greece. We don't know. It's all fiction. It's all PR.
Well, it is important, however, notwithstanding those points that you've raised, that we understand the American struggle, the American and human plight, and to record that in ways that are understandable to people. You are now a master storyteller. You have a unique perspective because of your background and the way you see it. How does your telling stories and our ability to tell stories shape public policy, public opinion? How do we translate this into ways in which we can improve the way justice is dispensed in this country?
You know, a long time ago, I think that books could have a much bigger impact today than today, because you had, well, start with Uncle Tom's Cabin. Mm-hmm. That book almost started the Civil War. I mean, it had a huge impact on the country because it described slavery in terms that a lot of people had never seen before. You know, Abe Lincoln told Harry Beecher Stowe, when he met her, he said, here's a little lady who started the Civil War. Fast forward 100 years, To Kill a Mockingbird in the early 60s, good book, great movie, back to back, had a huge impact because it was so famous that people around the world read it and saw it, and for the first time saw Jim Crow in the 1930s. That's right. And so my longtime editor in the UK is from Scotland, and he said when he read that book and saw that movie, his whole class, they couldn't believe it was true, that people were really treated that way in America. So that book had a huge impact. Some books are like that, I think, historically. Nowadays, though, when you have, because all you had back then were newspapers, before television, books, magazines. Now there's so much information. We see everything up close, live, every night on the news, 24-hour news, the internet. There's so much information now. I'm not sure books have that impact. What I try to do, though, when I write a book with an issue, and the issue can be wrongful convictions or death penalty or legal aid or environmental destruction or whatever, you know, denial of access to justice, civil justice, whatever my idea is for that story, I try to craft it around a legal thriller, a suspenseful story that people can rip through in 2 or 3 days. And then when the book is over, they think about that issue, but maybe they've never thought about it before. So what I want to do is raise awareness with the issues that I care about. And it's not my role. I don't have to do it. I could write every, you know, the book I published last fall was The Exchange. It's a sequel to The Firm. There's no issue in the book. It's pure entertainment. All the books are designed to be entertaining. Okay, I don't kid myself and tell people I'm trying to write serious literary art. That stuff doesn't sell. I want to sell, okay?
Well, here's the good news. The good news is what you get from what you sell, you share. And part of who we are as a people is not what we receive, but what we give. You are not only interested in writing books, you're interested in the human condition. And you think about that, and not only think about it, but you act on it. There are other things other than writing books that drive you and your family. Talk about some of those things that are part of building a better society.
Thank you. My wife is on the board of Share Our Strength, which is the parent group of No Kid Hungry. And we're doing a lot of work with childhood hunger, because childhood hunger is one issue that can be solved in this country. We also do a lot of work. There's enough food in America to feed everybody. And there are enough food programs, money that's already designated, spent, and food purchased to feed everybody. The problem is getting it to the kids, the hungry kids, and their families, and there are a lot of them. And so we do a lot of work with No Kid Hungry. My wife and I look at, you know, all the opportunities we have, and we focus on hunger, homelessness, and injustice. Those are the main three, and you have to find a focus, because there's so many different ways to give. When we do a lot, but we realize homelessness cannot be solved. We can do better. We can do a lot better. Injustice civil and criminal, is never going to really be solved, but we can do a whole lot better. I would do a lot of work with wrongful convictions. I'm on the board of the Innocence Project and also Centurion Ministries. And I spend a lot of time working on wrongful conviction cases. And if we would change about 5 or 6 laws in this country, state by state, we could go a long way to eliminating more wrongful convictions. And we're making progress, slowly making progress in those areas. It can be done, but you're never going to, you know, completely eliminate wrongful convictions. That's the kind of stuff that you know keeps me awake at night.
Well, it also translates on the civil side as well.
Yeah.
I mean, part of what we're trying to do is educate. I mean, you are a former legislator, former member of the Mississippi House of Representatives. We have to educate those who are there in a place that can make a difference every day. Talk to us about that. Talk to us about telling the story to those who can make a difference for us, whether they're in the legislature, whether they're in business, whether they're just there trying to understand how to be a positive factor in the civil justice system.
When I ran for the state legislature, I was 28 years old, which should be against the law in every state. My opponent had been there for a long time, and I knew I was confident I could beat him. It was a very close race, and I won the race by all those votes in my trailer park. We realized
that's a new meaning to a class action.
We realized a lot of folks in the trailer park were not registered, and we fixed that overnight. We got them registered, and then every trailer had a big Grisham sign in the front yard, popped up against it. They all had bumper stickers, banners, billboards. That was my territory, and I got all those votes and won. I ran for the legislature because when I was in law school, and when I was in college at Mississippi State, law school at Ole Miss, at that time, late 70s, Mississippi was still the only state with no public kindergarten system. And we knew that as college students, and we were very bothered by that. When I was in law school, there's a long tradition at the Ole Miss Law School, probably most states, of those graduates, lawyers serving in the state legislature. That was the launching ground for politics back then. And I had 4 buddies, and we all decided to run in 1983, 2 years out of law school, to run for the state legislature to try and bring about educational reform and establish a state kindergarten system. That was my motive for running. The job paid $8,000 a year, took up half your time, so you really couldn't say you did it for money. And when three of the 4 got elected, 1 became governor. But we went to Jackson, Mississippi, the state capital, with those very idealistic notions in mind, and I'd like to say we did some good. I frankly couldn't stand public service. What I realized, once you get elected, everybody, I don't care how close the race was, everybody voted for you. Everybody. And most of them want something. They want small things, a driver's license, passport, ticket fixed, or job. Everybody wants a job. Jobs. And I had no staff. We had no staff back then. We had no secretary. We had to do it all ourselves. And the first term, 2 or 3 years into my first term, I realized that I really was bad at constituent service. I got to where I couldn't stand the voters. And when you're a politician, you can't stand the voters, it's time to quit. You know?
John, the next time we do this, I really want you to tell us how you really feel about subject matter. Let me close with this. You have 2 children. Daughter's a school teacher, North Carolina. Son has his own law practice, Charlottesville, Virginia. By the way, that's a great state that you live in. I want you to close your comments with this. You've just told us you don't know the background of that legislator that you have to talk to. You don't know the background of that judge that you're going to appear before. You don't know the background of individuals who can make a difference. So there's a certain amount of discipline that we have to have in the way we approach solving these problems of great magnitude. But at the end of the day, we all put on our clothes the same way, one leg at a time. Talk to us about the discipline that you have had to have to do the work that you've had to do, and about the discipline we have to do the work that we have to do.
I'm not sure I can talk about your discipline. I'll try to talk about mine, and it looks a whole lot more rigorous than you might think. I write for 3 or 4 hours every morning. If I'm at home, it's every morning, but I'm home most of the time, and that's about 1,000 words a day, and that's a lot of words in the course of a year. And I have so many ideas for future novels. I'm still, I think, like a lawyer. The law is where my interests are. And I'm always looking at the law, lawyers, judges, courts, trials, appeals, trends in litigation, law firms blowing up, those sensations, even crime. Those stories are, that's what I like to read. And when, I tell people, when you study lawyers, okay, the material is endless because of all the things they do. Usually, most lawyers are honest, hardworking people who don't make a lot of money, okay? Nobody wants to read about those guys. You want to read about the crook who stole the money and faked his death and, you know, whatever. Those are the fun stories. But I have a lot of ideas. I could have stopped years ago. But also what I've learned over the years is, and this doesn't motivate, greed doesn't motivate me. I've realized that the more I write and the longer I go on and the you know, whatever, it gives me more opportunities to help people. And that's what we as a family really enjoy doing is helping those who are less fortunate, and especially for the causes we believe in. And that's motivational.
Ladies and gentlemen, we should have more storytellers that understand the need for access to justice, to understand the need for fairness, and to understand how to protect the promise. For all the things that you've done, for all the things that you do, and all the things that you see an opportunity for us to raise that bar, to raise that standard, we want to thank you for always being there for us, for participating in our organization's activities, and to bring the word to us that we should keep the faith, that we should continue to believe. And if you can believe, if you can conceive, then you can achieve 50 more years. Thank you, John.
Thank you, Bob.
Podcast guest speakers' views, thoughts, and opinions are solely their own and do not necessarily represent the Legal Services Corporation's views, thoughts, or opinions. The information and guidance discussed in this podcast are provided for informational purposes only and should not be construed as legal advice. You should not make decisions based on this podcast content without seeking legal or other professional advice.